This is a podcast from RNIB's Insight Radio.
Now, at West Point, the motto is duty, honour and country, and few cadets ever took that more seriously than Scott Smiley. Scotty, known to his friends, graduated in 2003, just after the start of the Iraq War, and by 2005 he was a platoon leader in northern Iraq. Scotty, hi there.
Hey, Alan, it's great to be on with you.
Just want to take you back a little bit, Scotty. Was it something you always wanted to do, is become part of the military?
It was and it wasn't. I think for me, getting a great education, originally from Washington State, was always a opportunity that I looked for. I saw a lot of opportunity. But on September 11th, when we were attacked my junior year, I really began to understand that the freedoms that we live in this world are not free, and that many men and women have to sacrifice their lives. And so my idea of joining the military and being a part of a greater service really changed while at the military academy, and I really looked towards my goal and service that much deeper and that much greater.
It almost sounds as if that sense of duty kicked in very early.
It did, and it's surprising. Many of the men and women who are serving at the military academy as cadre and our leaders had not been deployed. We had maybe one or two that had been in the Gulf War when we first went to Iraq in the early 90s, but that sense of service and freedom wasn't necessarily instituted in us other than theoretically. But once we saw veterans coming back and really understood the full gamut of sacrifice, it really began to impart a really deeper understanding of what giving your life for your country meant.
Did you have a plan before 9/11 of what your life was going to be?
I did, and it's sad to say it was a little bit more selfish than honorable or duty given at, you know, duty, honor, country, in which the military academy lives by. I looked at getting a good education, spending a little time in the military academy, learning leadership skills and techniques, and then getting out and getting a higher education and then becoming a businessman as an end goal for myself. But with that in mind, as the opportunities and really full understanding of what our freedoms really were worth began to change my perspective in life and truly my goals and what I wanted to do later on.
You graduated in 2003, and not long after that, you were married as well.
I was. So I was able to be a part of the 2% club. Apparently only 2% of the cadets who enter the military academy leave with the same partner that they enter in. And my now beautiful bride, Tiffany, was someone who I dated in high school, just an absolutely beautiful woman. Luckily enough, I was able to hold on strong enough to continue date. And after my infantry officer basic course down in Fort Benning, Georgia, we were married. And again, just an amazing woman who loves me and continues to support me. So it was a great, it was a lot of fun, really good memories.
Was Tiffany prepared then to be the wife of a military man?
I don't think she was, nor was I necessarily fully understanding the sacrifices and what it meant to be a military man either. You know, we talk about what it'll be like in the Army at the military academy. We say what sacrifice is, but in true form, it's only theoretical. It's not until you really live the life and understand the early mornings, the late nights, and the hours, if not weekends or weeks away, that you truly begin to understand what that sacrifice means. And more so, when you receive orders to deploy somewhere, and it's sad to say, don't know if you will come back, or if you do come back, if you will be truly the same person. So for both of us, it was a huge learning curve in which we both had deep conversations on what our relationship meant and what both of our plans in life were for. You know, was it going to be, you know, live a life in the military? Was it us both giving? Because that's truly what it means. It's not just one person, but it is a true family, a sacrifice for service.
Now, by 2005, you were serving in northern Iraq. You were a platoon leader. What was the day-to-day stuff like there? I mean, we saw it all in the news, but what was it like being there yourself?
Yes, I was a platoon leader in charge of roughly 45 men. I was a part of a striker unit, eight-wheeled vehicles, amazing, strong, troop-leading vehicles. We had destroyed the government in 2003, taking out Saddam and his men. But it was now a country in which needed support, helping rebuild the army, helping train the army, helping to provide security to the police force. I remember helping rebuild schools, parks, just the devastation that had occurred, not just from the war, but the chaos thereafter. They really needed our support. And so every day we were providing that security and well-being to the people. And I could really see the good in which we were doing, while at the same time, insurgents and terrorists were constantly trying to provide chaos. And that's what, you know, kind of began to pull some of the soldiers down and really fully understand the sacrifice in which we were giving.
This probably sounds an obvious question, but was it a frightening place to be? How did you cope with those duties with, you know, all these possible attacks going on all around you?
Yeah, it was scary. It was frightening. And we look at men, you know, in movies as, oh, wow, he's such a hero. There is no fear. But I truly believe every man has fear. But it's what you do with that fear and which really makes the men and women the heroes. And for me, there's a sense of belonging. I remember one of the first things that I wrote in a journal that I kept was I felt at home. I felt that this was the place that I was supposed to be. I was supposed to help these men and women rebuild their lives, rebuild the security of the country. But every day, our unit was attacked. It was hard. Improvised explosive devices in the roads, underneath, on the side, in cars, suicide bombers. Six of my men were seriously injured, either being shot or improvised explosive devices being blown up. It was hard. It was fearful.
Was it hard to maintain those values? Was it hard to carry on when you're seeing friends and members in your platoon being injured?
It was hard, and it is difficult just standing by the values in which we support and that we have. I remember on December 21st of 2004, the day after my first year anniversary, my company commander, Captain Bill Jacobson Jr., and 21 other men and women in the military forces were killed when a man walked into the cafeteria and blew himself up. And it's just, you know, just the devastation. The man who I reported to every morning, every night, would wake me up in the middle of the night, his life was taken. And it's hard to not have animosity and anger towards, you know, everyone there. But again, it was those values, our duty. Our duty was to help them, was to provide a sense of security and not lash out in anger. And many men and women had that same anger, but it was recalling the values that we had. Our moral and ethical duty is to do the right thing and not lash out in anger.
The duty obviously is coming across quite strongly there. And, you know, many of our listeners and myself anyway probably think, you know, how does duty keep you anchored when that kind of thing is going on? You don't know who these people are, if they're coming near you. Are they friendly? Are they enemies? Do they mean you harm? It almost sounds as if you have to be on your wits all the time.
You're right. And that is one of the hard things, is there's always a sense of adrenaline through your body. The second you go out the gate, you know, you've locked and loaded, you've put a round into the chamber of your weapon. And your sense of where you are, your attention to detail, hey, was garbage there before? Was that jersey barrier located at that location, you know, yesterday or the, you know, a week before? It's always a sense of a heightened level. While at the same time, we had men and women around us that would keep us rooted in what we were supposed to believe in. And so if men were acting out, you had other men and women there to either help control them or pull them back. But again, like you mentioned, every day it was hard. You had to be rooted in what we believed in those values and in those in that belief structure. Otherwise, you know, it was a hard job to accomplish.
Now, your life changed forever on one of those days, just going about your duties. Tell us about that.
Yes, on April 6th of 2005, my platoon specifically was given a mission to find a suicide car bomb in the city. And one would say, well, that's pretty easy. Well, in a city of over 2 million people, hundreds of thousands of cars, it's a needle in a haystack. And as I was traveling in the urban areas, urban neighborhoods, I found a car that was lower in the back than it was in the front. And just given the suspiciousness of that vehicle, I cordoned him off. I parked my Striker vehicle about 30 yards away. He was on the northern side of an east-west running road. I was on the southern side. Nothing in between us, no median, just empty space. I felt protected in my Striker vehicle, metal all around me up to my chest, had a helmet on, bulletproof glasses. But it was just a single man in the driver's seat. Head was buzzed, face was buzzed, gray shirt on, and a little silver opal. But again, the back of the car was lower than the front. So I yelled at him to get out of his vehicle, and he looked at me over his left shoulder. Again, I'm almost parallel to him. I was facing east, he was facing west. And he looked over his shoulder and shook his head no, and then put his hands back on the steering wheel. I yelled at him again in the same manner. He again responded the same way, took his hands off the steering wheel, shook his head no, and then he let his foot off the brake. And I had a decision to make. And so I raised my M4 rifle, the weapon that I always carried, and I fired two rounds in front of his vehicle. And then boom, his whole car and himself disintegrated, sending shrapnel into both of my eyes, blinding me the rest of my life. I didn't wake up for about a week and a half, waking up in Walter Reed Army Medical Center back in Washington, D.C., and my life changed forever.
And you can hear the rest of Scott's story at 10 past 5 on today's afternoon edition.
Radio for the blind and partially sighted community across the UK. RNIB's Insight Radio.
Earlier, I was speaking with Scotty Smiley. He had the world at his feet, graduated from university, married his high school sweetheart, and joined the US military. What happened in Iraq changed Scotty's life forever.
I found a car that was lower in the back than it was in the front. And just given the suspiciousness of that vehicle, I parked my Striker vehicle about 30 yards away. He was on the northern side of an east-west running road. I was on the southern side. Nothing in between us, no median, just empty space. I felt protected in my Striker vehicle, metal all around me up to my chest. Had a helmet on, bulletproof glasses, but it was just a single man in the driver's seat. Head was buzzed, face was buzzed, gray shirt on, and a little silver opal. But again, the back of the car was lower than the front. So I yelled at him to get out of his vehicle, and he looked at me over his left shoulder. Again, I'm almost parallel to him. I was facing east, he was facing west. And he looked over his shoulder and shook his head no, and then put his hands back on the steering wheel. I yelled at him again in the same manner. He again responded the same way, took his hands off the steering wheel, shook his head no, and then he let his foot off the brake. And I had a decision to make. And so I raised my M4 rifle, the weapon that I always carried, and I fired two rounds in front of his vehicle. And then boom, his whole car and himself disintegrated, sending shrapnel into both of my eyes, blinding me the rest of my life. I didn't wake up for about a week and a half, waking up in Walter Reed Army Medical Center back in Washington, D.C. My life changed forever.
Was that the last image that you have sort of in your head that you could actually see?
It's sad to say, but yes. I try to not focus on it. It's sad to say that is the last image that I remember seeing. But if it wasn't for forgiveness, I think my life would be different than what it is now.
When you eventually woke up in the hospital and they gave you the news, how did they break it to you?
It was hard. And again, these are memories that I don't like to focus on, though it is reality. I, for some reason, knew that something bad had happened. I was halfway mentally there, knew my wife was there holding my hand, while at the same time I was in type of a dream state. They did put me into a medically induced coma. But once I was fully out of it, and the doctor, you know, literally, it's sad to say, but whispered into my ear and said, "Scotty, I'm sorry to say, but you'll never be able to see again the rest of your life." It was fear, absolute fear. I personally didn't believe I deserved it. I thought I had lived a better life than this. I just didn't believe that this is something that could have happened to me. And that fear resonated through me in who I was and what I was, how I treated my wife. I was raised as a Christian, and God was now someone who I was denying because I thought I had done the right things. I read my Bible. I went to church. I did what I thought was right. I upheld the Army standard. And now my life had changed forever, not being able to ever see again. It was not a life that I wanted to live.
We mentioned earlier the duty, the rock that kept you grounded. Had that gone?
Yes. The depression that I was in, which I was very depressed, I was in a very dark, deep, black hole, was a hole in which I had decided to put myself into. That God was still there for me. He was still loving me. My wife was still there. My family was still there. And that's not always the case for others. Many times family members leave them, spouses leave you. Your family may not be there to support you. Well, at the same time, it's a personal decision that I had made to steep into that depression. And for me, it had to begin with forgiveness. I had to forgive the man who blew himself up, who had disintegrated his body, the car, blinding me the rest of my life, injuring several other members in my platoon, that I had to forgive him to wake up every morning now with a smile on my face, living life to its fullest. While at the same time, the most important decision I had to make was to ask God to forgive me for denying him. And I think it's that decision that I made, and you know, asking God back into my heart.
Did your family then have to almost help you soak up that anger, that frustration, in order to help you get things back on track again, climb out of that hole?
I think they did, and I think, I don't know if they mentally, consciously made that decision. I think at the same time, they knew personally I wasn't going to be able to do it on my own. The weakness, the frailty, the brain injury that I received, my left eye being cut in half, metal going into my frontal lobe, did partially paralyze the right side of my body, and I literally was I was incapable of doing much for myself. And so that love and that support was there, while at the same time, the love and support wasn't there just to hold my hand every moment, every day, and not give me any type of independence. They realized that the independent person I was before still was inside the body that I was now living with.
Was there a point that you can say, yeah, that was it, that you decided everything had to change, you had to turn things around and get back out there?
I think there was, and many men and women would come in and visit me, and you know, it was very honorable, and I really appreciate the support and love that the community had for me. While at the same time, I never wanted to be looked at as just oh, that poor guy, oh man, that's so sad. Again, I think there's a lot of pride in me in which I didn't want it. And it was a little boy one day, my wife came into the room and said, "Hey, Scotty, Andrew Harris wants to come in and say hi." And Andrew was a little boy who I had taught Sunday school to when I was a cadet at the military academy. And I realized, you know, this little boy still looks up to me. This little boy is here to be by my side. And me, broken, just a miserable wreck in the hospital bed, literally I just started crying for about 10 minutes before he came in the room, realizing that, you know, if God was going to use me to positively influence little children and or, you know, adults, I had to make a decision. Did I want to, you know, if this was the purpose in life, I could still do it being blind. And I think, you know, I don't know if Andrew Harris really understood the impact that he had on my life, But I truly don't believe it was what I did for him, but it was what he did for me. And it was that time in my life that I knew, hey, you need to toughen up. You need to, you know, this is life. Life's not perfect. Life is not a box of chocolates. You got to toughen up and make a decision to improve and to begin to live life to its fullest. And I think it was at that point that the forgiveness came to my mind, and I needed to grab life and do everything I could to help in some type of way, help others deal with issues that I was dealing with and many more.
You talk about God and you talk about religion as being a big part of your life from the very early days. Was there a bit of a conflict then? Had God chosen this path for you to go down, and was there anger at that choice being made for you?
Oh, you better believe it. There was a lot of anger, a lot of resentment. And I think, you know, the Bible says all things worked for the glory of God. While at the same time, I don't like saying that my suffering is for his glory. But, you know, in stating that, if I know that it took breaking me apart, breaking me down to my most raw form to truly understand that God's love, you know, that God loves me no matter what, who I am, what my disabilities or abilities are, but it's my love towards him and what I can do for him is what really matters. It's sad to say if that's what it took, that is what it took. But there was that anger, there was that animosity, and there was, for me, that fear. Is how was I going to be able to do this? How was I going to be able to live life? And I think in its true form, who I was and what I was wasn't because of my own doing. It was because God had enabled me to attend the military academy. And I think all of the assistance in which enabled me to graduate from the military academy, the love of my family and the support that I was given helped me and put me where I was. And in that same way, that support had to be there for me in my weakest point, at my weakest moment.
You were presented with the Purple Heart, which is a great honour. What was it like at the presentation? Did you think, I'm being given this and that's it, you know, my career's over? Or was it, I've been given this, I want to get back in uniform?
I don't know if it was truly accepted, this was for the sacrifice of my country, or just, hey, your life has changed. It is going to be different. But I do remember just crying, a weakened and fearful person, and wanting the award to be taken off my chest. You know, the recognition was too great. I didn't want to accept the change in my life. I didn't want to accept the injuries in which I had been given, because it meant that my life was changed and my life was different.
And you wanted to serve again. How do you build yourself back up physically and mentally to a point where you can say to your superiors, I want to come back?
Oh, I mean, it is a one huge challenge. And I think for me, it was not just a monthly, but more so hourly basis. That, you know, it's time to get out of bed. It's time to go do physical therapy. You need to do your occupational therapy. As boring or as monotonous or as hard as it was, I realized I had to push myself. And I think there was a kind of twinged or I don't want to say demented person behind that recovery. But for me, I wanted to still serve my country. I still wanted to give back. And I realized there were soldiers who had been injured when we first deployed, did recover, and were able to come back to Iraq. And so for me, there was a sense of you need to recover so you can go back and be with your men and be a leader. And so that's what really kept me going and really pushing me forward. But most of all, I needed to learn how to live as a blind person. So quickly recovering from Walter Reed after a little less than 2 months, I went to the Blind Rehabilitation Center in Palo Alto, California, all the way across the country near the Pacific Coast, to learn how to use a blind stick, to learn how to use a computer, to learn how to, read in Braille, learn how to cook, learn how to be an independent person. And every day was hard. It was, you know, the parking lot. Never get lost in a parking lot. Always use your ears to understand where you are located. But it was that drive and that desire. It was the love of my wife. It was the Army and that companionship that just inspired me to constantly and continually recover, in which I was very surprised that the United States Army has a policy if very seriously injured and still mentally strong and physically capable, still can serve. And for me, it was that service and those values in which I still supported, and the worth in which I saw in myself, gave me a reasoning and gave me the purpose behind wanting to continue to serve.
I lost my sight back in 2000, Scott, and one thing that I kind of regret, I don't regret a great deal, but one thing I kind of regret is I don't know what my wife looks like. I don't know what my kids look like. I have this impression in my head. Is that something you have because you're a dad as well?
Yes, it is. And I said it a little bit ago. I literally married the most beautiful woman in the world. So I beat you just by a little. you know, we still have the sense of touch. We still can feel, while at the same time, sometimes the movies in which we see kind of gives this perception, well, you feel their face, an instantaneous picture pops up in your mind. Well, I'm sorry, for me, that's not how my brain works. And so there is a disconnect with, you know, the knowledge of how beautiful my wife looks. And I never have seen my children. The oldest is 7, the youngest is 2. I never have seen how they look. And it's sad to say that I never will. But it's still that love that, you know, they're there for me, I'm there for them. That connection with my wife, the connection, you know, the emotional connection, the spiritual and the physical and mental are still there. And I think that's what just, you know, constantly gives me the drive to love them, to be there for them.
You're a captain now in the military. You're back in the place you love. You're doing a job that you want to do. You know, I was looking at some of the stuff here. You've done mountain climbing, skiing, there's jumping out of planes, triathlons. Are you proving something to yourself, or do you think you prove something to other people that the sight isn't a barrier, is no longer a barrier?
It's not about sight. It's not about the disabilities we have, but it's about what we can constantly and continually do. I was a very active person before I was blinded, and you know, though a lot of my independence was taken from me, I still wanted to be a physical person. I still wanted to go out and have activities and to be a part of society in the best way possible. And so for me, it's not about making a name for myself. It's not about showing people what I can still do, but it's about just having fun and living life to its fullest, enjoying God's beautiful creation, you know, being able to physically stay in shape. That's what really keeps me driving on. And you know, like you said, showing people that, you know, don't give up on life. Live life to its fullest. It's taking advantage of what has been given to us and not focusing on what has been taken from us. And I think that's what really pushes me on.
The job you do, you help service personnel get their lives back together again. Is this part of the path that God put you on, do you think? Do you think you're the perfect person to do this for those people?
I don't know if I'll ever be a perfect person or the most perfect person, but I think, you know, it is a calling. Is we all have been given paths in life to choose, and I think the path in which God has placed me on and the path that I have chosen has put me in a particular position to help those who are struggling, people who have, you know, post-traumatic stress, who are hurting, because I have dealt with it, I have been through it, and I think we all still will deal with it, and it's going through those problems and the fact that I have God in my life and a loving wife and a loving family and can see where that path has taken me. I think I have a great ability of helping others, always having a listening ear, and being, you know, quick to listen and slow to speak has really given me an opportunity to help remold lives in a way in which helps people live to their fullest.
What about the future then? What does that hold for Scott Smiley?
Well, the Army has been amazing, and I just thank everyone who has served for this country and served for the for the peace of this world. But I think, you know, all good things must come to an end. And I am departing from the Army, medically retiring here in a few months. And for me, it's about helping other people grow, and whether it be in public speaking, traveling the world, traveling and helping people fully understand what their capabilities are. I think that's where, you know, God and my family has planned, is just to help people understand how they can help, and those values, and what the Army has helped me fully understand, and just helping others recover from the hurt and pain. I think that's a good road ahead for me. It's a good starting point.
Scott, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Good luck, and thank you for speaking with us.
Well, thank you, Alan. It's been great being with you, and again, same to you.